Here we are, Katie.
Here we are, Patrick. Back again for our Sunday main course.
Sunday main course at the Heritage Radio Network in lovely Roberta's Restaurant in Bushwick, Brooklyn. Have you had the food here, Katie?
No, I haven't. But I have had the pizza, which is unbelievably delicious. They have a wood-fired oven up in the front there.
Yeah.
And it comes out really thin and crispy and totally yummy.
And that same oven like prepares the pork chops and the steaks, and then it gets sent to the back of the house. Yeah, they were surviving without gas for the longest time, which is a challenge, but it also forced them to do the most simple preparations that are really good.
Less is more in the culinary world, in my opinion.
I am excited about this week's show. We have three guests, all in-house. There's no call-ins. We turn the call-in machine off.
Yeah, that's a beautiful thing. We have Steve Jenkins from Fairway, who's going to be our first guest today. And then we have...
Now, you've known Steve for a few years, right?
Easily 25.
Wow.
Probably almost as long as I've been in New York, which is over 30. So, yeah.
How's he holding up? Is he...
Looking better than ever!
Wow.
And he's showing us his tummy now, too.
Awesome.
Next thing you know, we'll be rubbing it if we
for good luck.
Giving him a pink belly, yeah.
So we're going to talk cheese with Steve. Steve is the author of The Cheese Primer, but, you know, one of the first founders of any type of artisanal culture in this country, you know, in terms of having shepherded that to New Yorkers at Dean and DeLuca and now Fairway, and a million things to talk about with Steve. And then we have Cruz Goller, the chef of Lupa Restaurant, which is one of my favorite restaurants.
Absolutely. One of Mario and Joe Bastianich's fabulous places.
Right, with Jason Denton. And our friend Mark Ladner used to be the chef there, and then it passed on to Steve Connaughton, and now Cruz is maintaining the high standards. I love Lupa because of how inexpensive it is.
Yes, absolutely. Nothing. And it's really serious commitment to Roman food, Roman trattoria food.
Exactly. The Trastavera, is that neighborhood in Rome that they, try to imitate? And then, you know, they actually buy like 400 pounds of Heritage Foods' pork shoulder every week, which is that anchor order that allows the rest of the animal to get sold. You know, where the shoulder goes is where the pig goes a little bit, if you can get a good price for the shoulder.
Yeah, it makes sense to me.
Yeah, it's like 16 pounds per animal of this kind of braisable cut. So they make all their dishes with that cut. And then we have Nikki Rose, who's in from Greece, just for the show.
I don't know
if that's true or not. But
I don't know about that, but I do know that she will be telling us about eco-agrotourism in Crete, which seems to be her specialty. I'm looking forward to hearing more about that.
Where's the word Cretan come from? Is that someone from Crete? Like, is that what Spartacus...
Well, it depends on how you spell it. If it's C-R-E-T-A-N, then it's somebody from Crete. But if it's a Cretan, C-R-E-T-I-N, then you're talking about a moron.
Awesome. I love having Katie here. She's so much smarter than me. She knows how to spell and everything.
I do know how to spell. Yeah.
So some of the issues I'm going to bring up, and we have a couple more minutes before we go to Steve. I printed out this really awesome article that I'm going to bring up with Cruz, about Ferran Adrià opening a pizza place.
Yeah.
And it brought up all these interesting things about, like, is it his right as a Spaniard to make an Italian dish? And, you know, there's a real blog sphere explosion in Italy because of this.
Well, that makes me laugh. But what I thought was even more interesting was the discussion later on in that article, which was, I think, in the Washington Post or the LA Times, that talked about the chemicals that are being used in foods now, like hydrocolloidals, which I know about because I went to a really interesting presentation at the French Culinary Institute about a year or so ago. And they were demonstrating sous vide cooking and, that super slow temperature cooking. And they were also demonstrating some of the things that they use to make froths and foams and meat glue, which is a hydrocolloidal. And a comment that Tom Colicchio made to me when I was interviewing him about something else was that, you know, a whole generation of chefs had done their best to get away from using any kind of chemicals in the kitchen and to, you know, go for the very clean, natural, all natural effect in food. And here are these guys who are like playing with gadgets and toys, including all these weird chemicals. You know, I'm not saying it's good or bad because I don't think they're particularly dangerous. They're certainly used in industrial food. Yeah. We all eat them if we eat industrial food.
But if you charge $400 for a meal, it's okay. It's like, you know, a crazy person, but if they're rich, they're eccentric.
Yeah, there you go.
Well, we'll cut to a 30-second break and come back with, American hero.
Absolutely.
Changing my employment. to increase my enjoyment. Well, they say I got laid off. Well, at least I got laid. Changing my employment to increase my enjoyment. It could have been a whole lot harder if my decision weren't already made. They were always talking loud, but they were never saying nothing. Talking about creation and commitment and being and becoming. Payday came and went, and the cash wasn't there. And when they offered me minimum wage, well, I fled from that cage. Changing my employment to increase my enjoyment.
Back at the main course, which is sponsored this week by Esposito's Fine Quality Sausages, which is an old institution back from the 20s or before on, I think it's like 38th and 10th Avenue.
I think that's right. Yeah.
Yeah, and they buy all our trim, so it was very nice of David Samuels to be sponsoring us and helping Steve Jenkins come on through the sponsorship. Welcome, Steve.
Hi, Patrick. Thank you.
What's going on? So where are you coming from? Tennis, I hear.
Yeah, it's a Sunday ritual for me to play 2 hours of tennis and scream and yell with my best friends and get sweaty and get some exercise.
What courts do you play on?
Religiously at Randall's Island. I mean, we can drive there blindfolded. It's one of the great unsung little spas of New York City that we really don't want anybody to know about. Except, you know, the Icahn Field is out there now, this gorgeous track field that Carl Icahn funded just a couple years ago. And so they have track meets there in this beautiful stadium with a beautiful track. And I noticed Cirque du Soleil's out there right now. So they got all those wacky tents.
I saw those colorful tents. I used to play baseball in high school and we would go to Randall's Island, but that was
really
back in the, you know, early 80s. I was like, you know, diving in center field onto syringes and all
broken glass
stuff.
And rocks, yeah. And stuff. Yeah.
I was like, I've been stabbed. And my coach is like, get up, butthead. Come on. Throw the ball in.
The firemen have their big, huge training facility back there, too.
Oh, really?
Oh, they set stuff on fire and jump off of it and everything. It's amazing.
Thank God for Randall's Island. And then Ward's Island, right next to Randall's Island, I think is a prison.
Yeah.
We always used to yell at the prison guys, poor guys, as if they needed, like, eighth graders.
Great. You're heckling a bunch of guys that are unfortunate.
That's a beautiful thing.
I know. Sorry, listen, I'm just being truthful. We're fully traceable here at Heritage Radio Network.
That's right.
But, you know, you can hike back.
Be tracing you back.
You can hike back from those courts, and it's just beautiful because the city and Bloomberg have really spent time and money fixing that whole area up. It's just lovely. Of course, until you get to the East River, and then you have to come back to Manhattan.
Yeah, that's not. Now, do you eat a lot? I mean, do you need to work out? I mean, are you constantly eating cheese, or are you just like tasting, or do you know all the cheeses already?
I'm finally at the age of 58, unable to metabolize the vast amounts of things that I've been cramming down my gullet all these years, and my gut sticks out a little bit more every day. I used to be a god.
You're still a god, Steve. Come on.
I am aged out of that thing where women or men or anybody would look at me and think, hey, that's a pretty good looking dude.
Nonsense.
It doesn't
hear it.
It helps if you're standing behind your cheese counter.
Yeah, they
which,
couldn't
you know,
see me from
awesome.
The waist down or the
right.
chest
your
down.
Apron.
They couldn't,
yeah.
couldn't see. So.
You're white.
Yeah, I got away with murder for years, but now the jig is up with that.
This is what women used to do, and now this is what they do.
That's right.
So, Katie, you have you been shopping at Dean and DeLuca back when you came? I mean, Steve's early work?
Well, I actually knew Steve from even before his Dean and DeLuca days. Mm-hmm. Steve and I both worked for a chain called Pasta and Cheese back in the 70s. And this was small chain. They had about 8 stores, I think, altogether, that was owned by a jeweler named Henry Lambert.
Who I am back in touch with, called up out of the blue like a month ago.
I had lunch
with him on the east side.
Really?
It was the strangest experience.
You'll have to tell me about that afterwards.
I've got to tell you about
that. But anyway, Henry was really a visionary, and Dean and DeLuca was open at that point, and Balducci's was open. But that was about it in terms of real gourmet foods. And I think it's hard for people to imagine that less than 30 years ago, the gourmet food industry simply did not exist in New York City. I mean, there was Casa Moneo on 14th Street if you needed Mexican foods. There
William
was
Dean Paul and DeLuca on Lexington.
That's right, right.
And Eli was up on 81st Street.
Sort of. He was?
Oh, yeah. He had one on 80th and Madison.
Or maybe he hadn't left the West Side.
I don't think... No, I think those came afterwards because he opened the Vinegar Factory before he opened Eli's, I think.
Oh, no.
I had Eli's. I lived on that block. So I know as of like 1978 or 9, he was there. My mom used to try to get those baguettes, you know, those very burnt ones that they...
The Ficelle.
But anyway, Henry had this gig going and Steve came in, and you were there for a few years before I was, and I think that's where you got your training in cheese, wasn't
it? That was in 79 when I couldn't take another day at Giorgio DeLuca, and I walked... And I joined up with Henry's outfit, who was the fresh pasta guy.
That's right.
The original guy to sell fresh pasta besides Raffetto.
Nobody had done that before.
Raffetto was the other one on Houston Street, but nobody from the east side ever went down to Houston Street to get Raffetto pasta because they were afraid of anything that far south.
Absolutely.
So Raffetto
and Henry
was
brought in things like, you know, extra virgin olive oils and sun-dried
tomatoes.
And
Marcello
Hazan
got onto Henry's fresh pasta, and they still didn't have any extra virgin olive oil. There wasn't any in the city anywhere. Those two phony brands, Louis de Régy and the Fabre, those were phony. Yeah. Those weren't really.
I did not know.
Or the Plagnol that looked like it came in a hair tonic bottle. There was no extra virgin olive. The first one that hit town was that idiotic snob Tuscan Colti Buono.
That's right. Badia e Colti Buono.
Owned by that woman whose last name was de Medici. The closest she ever got to the de Medici family was the guy she married, and he wasn't anywhere near close to him. So that was the first extra virgin olive oil, and I bought it for pasta and cheese for Henry's outfit.
Yeah.
From some guy who worked for a wine importer, from Leo Shaw, a sweet old guy that worked for Frederick Wildman Imports. That was the first extra virgin olive oil in the city.
Yeah. What held it up? Why was none of this stuff? Because people were obviously going to Italy back in the 60s, 70s. I mean, they weren't even going to Italy?
Nobody even knew it existed.
Well, that...
The only thing that was around was a Amostra oil that was bright green from Sicily that people thought was really good oil because it was so green, when in reality all that was the leaves that got crushed with the old nasty Greek olives that these Italians brought into Palermo. They weren't even Palermitano olives. I mean, it was the olive oil business has been the most corrupt part of the food industry of all for
and
for
remains,
many, many
I believe.
Well, yeah, but no, I'm an idiot savant. I spend tons more time with olive oil over the last decade than I have with cheese.
Is that right?
Yeah. Well, we're about to take a 30-second break, but when we come back, maybe we could talk a little bit about cheese.
We must talk about cheese.
Those very early years, I'm fascinated to know how that was unpacked and uncovered and introduced. So we'll be right back with Steve Jenkins on the Heritage Radio Network.
Yeah, Eli was had just...
Who's gonna grow your food when the farms are gone? Who's gonna grow your food when the farms are gone? And who's gonna grow your food when the farms are gone? Supermarket don't grow no food. Your meat when the ranches are gone. Who's gonna raise your meat when the ranches are gone? And who's gonna raise your meat when the ranches are gone? Supermarket don't raise no meat.
And we're back. It's Katie Kiefer with Patrick Martins, and today we have Steve Jenkins on the main course. Steve is a partner at Fairway, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, and has been for many years. But the most important thing about Steve, besides how incredibly cute he is his knowledge of cheese. So, Steve, let's hear a little bit. We were talking in the last segment about the history of sort of the rise of the gourmet food movement in New York City and really across the country. Let's talk a little bit about what you found when you first started doing, going abroad and buying cheese. Because I know you used to go out on those buying trips for pasta and cheese, and you were finding artisanal makers and forging relationships and bringing in raw milk cheeses before the FDA found out about that. Let's talk a little bit about that whole sort of marketing and how you got people interested.
We had nothing back in 77 when Dean and DeLuca opened that summer. I had already been working in some little cheese shops on the Upper East Side called HQZ Cheese Pantry. And we handled Jarlsberg and Danish cheeses.
I'd like some Jarlsberg cheese and a slice of brie, please.
And Belle Etoile and Beaumont. And,
yeah.
And Explorateur. And that was about it.
Oh, my God, Explorateur. That yeah, seems it was, pretty racy it was available. To me, considering.
Yeah, it was available then. And then I went down to Dean DeLuca, and everything changed because I was working for a couple of hipsters that had traveled and knew that there was stuff out there in Europe that was not in the United States. And I made it my business. At that point, I figured I can make a living doing this. That's all I cared about in those days, was that I could make a living. I was scuffling.
Sure.
And
me too.
there was nothing happening in New York City as regards food. There was Maxwell's Plum, and that was about it.
La Grenouille.
Exactly. But who could afford to go there? I couldn't.
Or Four Seasons.
I never went to any of those places.
Yeah, exactly. That was certainly out of our range.
So few restaurants, and then there were coffee shops. I mean, that's where mostly people ate, I guess.
And great Jewish delis like Gitlitz on Broadway and 79th, 77th Street.
Oh, my God. I forgot all about that.
77th.
What was that one on 60th between Madison and Park?
Beyond.
Oh, Beyond, that coffee shop.
Oh, going there for a big, thick turkey sandwich with real turkey on it?
Beyond is still there.
Beyond is still there.
Yeah. But they don't, it's not so great.
And Jackson Hole hamburgers.
Yes, that's right, yeah.
So anyway, there was nothing available in the city. There wasn't even any Parmigiano Reggiano, not even in Little Italy. Forget extra virgin olive oil. There was no Fontina d'Aosta. There was good handmade mozzarella, but that was a Little Italy thing. But,
yeah, you had to go to Little Italy to get it.
Had to go to Little Italy to get it. There was no French cheese, certainly no Spanish cheese, not even at Casa Maneo.
No.
And there was Cheese of All Nations that sold distressed cheeses that came from Scandinavia. But there was nothing from Italy and nothing from England that was real and nothing from France.
Yeah. Especially.
How did you break those barriers? I mean, what was the key? Did you meet producers in Europe?
The key was very clearly, and this is something I really want to get across to anybody that's a Ute out there and is wanting to find a life in food, is that I got it because Joel Dean was a book freak. He was with Simon and Schuster and hated it and got involved with Giorgio to open a food store, and his gig was bringing in cookbooks. Mm-hmm. So I had at my fingertips, though I had to pay for them all, every cookbook that had ever been written, and that means all of the Waverly Root and all of the M.F.K. Fisher, and all of the Elizabeth David, all of the Roy Andres de Groot. And these are the books that made my life complete. Because I learned everything there was to know about what had been written about food extant. And then on top of that, I made it my business to travel to find these little villages that I read about with Elizabeth David, Waverly Root, and M.F.K.
Fisher.
And by God, I made them my purlieus. That became my bailiwick. And since I was the first one, I got very proprietorial about it.
I didn't
just travel there and come back.
Right.
I came back and placed orders with my people in Paris, at Rungis, at the market, to get me this and get me that and this and that and this and this, this, and then gave them a list.
I see.
And by God, they got all of those things to me, and nobody had ever thought that. I mean, duh. How hard was that? It wasn't hard at all. Nobody had just ever thought to do it. So here I could bring 7 different farmers of brie into the country, 8 different camemberts, all of the cheeses that you could ever imagine from France all came to me. Completely illegal and were for years.
They were illegal because they were raw milk cheeses. They were not pasteurized cheeses.
They were not aged 60 days, and they were made from raw
milk.
Until
it took a few years before the FDA finally slammed that door shut.
Boy, oh boy.
And,
those were the rules back then.
Tremendous impact.
60 days old was also back in the 70s. That was also the rule.
Yeah, it's a law from the 30s. And it was what's his name, the New York Times restaurant critic that came after Mimi. You know, I'm just having a senior moment.
I can't remember either.
Not William Grimes, that he was way
later. No, not Bill Grimes. You know, he's a guitar player, really smart guy, really good writer, really good restaurant critic.
That's before I was born in 1995.
I'm having a senior moment. Anyway, he wrote about cheesemongers like me who were flouting the law and all the bells.
Oh, he revealed off. You guys. Ooh, that's not very good.
Yeah. I don't think he meant to. Do you?
I wrote him a letter and he never replied.
Well, it was too bad for him too, because we all suffered the consequences of that.
It died down a little bit, and I figured out how to bring him in anyway. I brought him in through Boston.
Uh-huh. God, you are
where
smart,
where those guys
Steve.
Weren't paying any attention. Yeah, so right? started all over again until we got busted in Boston. But I remember there were times when I'd have to go out to Port Elizabeth and with uniformed U.S. Customs people, I would have to break cheeses apart and pour borax on them in front of them in big barrels.
Oh, my God.
And it was like killing puppies. And this happened several times.
That's not very nice. God, they did that to, they do that with all these charcuterie things. They'll find it and force them to destroy it.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
So whereas when they're homeless people, not eating and all that, and it's been proven by centuries of tradition, it's quite ridiculous.
They're intractable.
Well, we're going to take one more minute break, and then we're going to come back with Steve Jenkins on the Heritage Radio Network.
Walking in my hometown, what did I happen to see just the other day? A woman with a clown, and though the woman made me hot, the clown just scared me away. Well, that's when it starts happening. When you start poking around your pathology, sometimes a cigar's just a cigar, and a clown's just something that you don't want to see. Oh yeah. Woo-hoo. I was feeling all beat down, the world was spinning around, the walls were falling on me. The doctor said with a frown, you got vertigo, son, it's very easy to see. But he didn't pay attention to the fact that I was dosing, and he was diagnosing me on the Ferris wheel. And he didn't listen when I told him he was being watched. And those sleuping killer bats with laser eyes are real, oh yeah. Woo-hoo. Na 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 na. I made a Freudian slip, now I'm forever young. And all those ink blots are looking so ominous. And Pavlov's bell's tolling, now it's time to come. But I'm beginning to spurn all these terms that I've learned. There's no phrase in psychology for my pathology. I can make it on my own. I hate to be alone, but I'm getting comfortable with myself, and I'm starting to see, oh yeah.
We're back. Woo-hoo. Yes, we are back. It's the Heritage Radio Network. We are listening to The Main Course with Steve Jenkins. He's our guest today. This is Katie Kiefer. We're with Patrick Martins. And this show is sponsored by Esposito Quality Sausages.
Yes, it is.
Steve, let's talk a little bit about American artisanal cheese and how the whole sort of cheese, the love of cheese in this country really took off. I mean, considering that when you and I started, or certainly when you started, it was Jarlsberg cheese only. And now we have not only great cheeses coming in from around the world, but we have great cheesemakers in the United States. So let's chat a little bit about how that's all evolved in the last few years, because that's a relatively new development, don't you think?
It's warp speed what's happened with American artisanal cheeses from 1985 till now. I mean, last August in Chicago at our American Cheese Society annual competition, we had 650 entries from North America.
Amazing.
And the competition was fierce and rapt, and we had extraordinary technical judges and the smartest aesthetic judges in the world at our competition. And it was a heady, heady ferment, and we're awfully proud of what's happened in North America. I say that because there's a lot of Canadians involved too, and they're wonderful, wonderful people as well. So we've got cheeses in this continent that not just rival, but are the equal and superior to anything that comes from Europe, certainly.
They've learned it that fast, huh?
Fast, and it's all because of those Europeans, because many of the smartest Americans and Canadians did study with really, really talented cheese makers in Europe. And oddly, some of them never have traveled to Europe at all and just are completely autodidacts, and through trial and error, the way cheese was created in the first place over several thousand years, these Americans have done it in the span of 2 decades. Mm. They make the most drop-dead, fabulous, delicious stuff that I've come across in 32 years of doing it.
Really?
And do they are these their own American varieties of cheeses, or are they basic copies of the Europeans? I mean, what are the differences?
There are a couple that are unique. There are the Grayson from Northern Virginia, which I have always said started out as a Mahon from Menorca, is really an original, an American original. Hmm. Dry Jack is an American original.
From Igvella?
Igvella, and out there where David Gremmels and Carrie Frankel bought the creamery. As well, the Tellamy from the Central Valley.
What about Maytag, that guy? I mean, wasn't
Maytag,
that blue cheese?
They had a high-powered Minnesota dairy consultant come in and teach them how to make cheese with recipe of Roquefort. So that's perfect example of a derivative cheese, as are all the cheeses in New Zealand and Australia, derivative. That's why what we're doing in this continent is so special, because we do have originals. Every place else is either the doctrinaire stuff that's been around for 2,000 years, 1,000 years, or it's like an American, it's a totally original, like our American cheddar, which is completely different from the Dorset, Somerset idiom.
Now, what other foods have exploded like that? I mean, I personally know, like, our bread culture was pretty sad, and there was Wonder Bread or nothing.
Yeah.
And that is also...
Farm, if you were upscale, right?
Right, yeah, exactly. Yeah. If you really were highfalutin. But is that just happening all over the place with our cuisine?
It happened in England, for sure, the same way beer and cheese happened in England. Bread happened in England. And in New York, in our area, we make the greatest bread in the world. There's no better bread anywhere in the world. No place in Spain, no place in Italy, no place in France. It makes bread as good in several bakeries as we make in New York City. Part of the reason why those of us that have been here so long could never, ever move away from New York, because the bread is so bloody good. There's just no bread, even in L.A., or San Francisco, that's as good as our bread.
Yes, and I would agree with that. I don't think anybody else has come up to this culture.
To this bread, milk bread. I mean, it's pretty fierce. And now I wanted to ask you, now you say you've been dedicating your past few years in olive oil. That's been like, is that a new kind of frontier to...
Well, it hasn't been for me, because I've been doing it for so long. But what I've done with olive oil is just cooler than what anybody else has ever even thought about doing with olive oil. I mean, I'm just so far ahead in anybody in the industry, it's laughable.
And
I've got 14 families in various parts of the Mediterranean basin in Australia and Mexico and California that provide oil for me that's fresh and unfiltered in barrels that ship to me, which means it's a third as expensive as it would be otherwise. And I pump it myself under vacuum pressure into my own ugly bottle with my own ugly label that I designed and that I write everything there is to know about that olive oil on the label, which is unheard of in the industry. You never know anything about an olive oil that you buy commercially, because it doesn't tell you where it came from, what variety it was, when it was pressed, what it's going to taste like, what it smells like, what it's best used for. But my labels do all of that work for you, and that's very cool. But
where you do you do all
you
this?
You can have a travelogue on an olive oil label, 14 different ones.
Wow.
Everyone with merit.
And you do
everyone
this,
with a story.
And you do this where, Steve? Where does this happen? You have
Fairway.
A big warehouse?
No, at Fairway.
Up on 130?
Yeah, up in Harlem.
Yeah.
And now you've, talking about Fairway, you've just expanded to a, is it Paramus? Is that
Paramus.
Paramus. Is that
Paramus. Yes, we have a new hideous box store in Paramus.
Is that what they call it? No, well, congratulations. I mean, Fairway, first of all, your Brooklyn store is like, should be considered a museum.
That's my favorite store of my career. My
Mecca.
Favorite store of my whole career.
That's
is
just
that right?
Fun to walk around, whether you buy anything or not.
That store is a joy to my idiot career, big time, and always will.
And it makes money even where it is there?
Yeah, we make payroll. But what makes it so cool is not just the fact that it's in a pre-Civil War building that we didn't change one iota. The people that shop there are the nicest, most wonderful, most food enthusiastic, most genuine, uncynical, sweet people that walk the earth. And that's a mouthful, man.
So you guys are providing an education for a whole area that really was totally underserved by
I would say
grocery.
Not an education. These people are so food savvy. We talk about food, not to them.
But you're bringing products in that they that simply were not in that part of Brooklyn at all, right?
Well, maybe not, but these folks are hip to all of that stuff.
Sure, but
No, I mean,
so,
they
it's an underserved
it's not
area.
Like, get a load of us and this cool stuff we're selling you. Mm-hmm. It's, oh, nice to see that. How about that? And then we talk about it. Mm-hmm.
Well, we are, Steve Jenkins is an amazing lone wolf in the industry. So we're big fans of Steve, and we're going to hopefully, Steve, if this if you have a Sunday tradition playing tennis, maybe this could be an off and on tradition that you come and give us more lessons and give all those listeners out there. So
it would be an honor.
Yeah, there's a lot of good stuff to talk about.
Well, now that Katie's here, right now. I know you'll never refuse an invitation.
Well, you and I are pretty good pals too.
I know we've known each other over a decade. When I first came in my slow food days, there were very few people who got it or cared, and Steve was both. So yeah. I'll always be in your debt for that, and even to this day, you support what I'm up to with the radio and Heritage Foods. So thanks for all that you do, Steve, and feel free to stay and keep drinking the beer.
That's so great. Fantastic.
Thanks. We'll be right back with Cruz Goller from Lupa Restaurant.
Down by the train, drink wine, cause they feel no pain. Knowing that my life will never be on track, I'm feeling like Rome after the garlic sack. A locomotive streams through the middle of my brain, and I'm fearing all the thoughts that are right on the train. Praying for the day when these demons all tame. The truth often stings, but lies will do the same.
So here we are, Katie Kiefer,
and Patrick Martins,
at the main course at Roberta's, and we have one of my favorite restaurants and favorite chefs here, Cruz Goller from Lupa. You've been to Lupa, right, Katie?
Not for quite a while, but yes, I have been to Lupa, and I was cruising your menu this morning, actually, just to make sure that I was, you know, up to speed on what's going on over there.
Cruising the menu, I like that.
I had to do that, come on.
When welcome, Cruz.
Name is Cruz. You got to say cruising. But yeah, it's cruising the menu. You guys have a great menu, and they are a restaurant that specializes in real Roman trattoria cooking, which isn't so regular. I mean, I think when people think of an Italian restaurant, they haven't gotten as specific as exactly where that cooking is coming from, and that's what's so fun about Lupa, I think.
How do you define the cuisine? Where is it? Is there a specific neighborhood in Rome? Or like, what is that cuisine at your restaurant?
I'd say a lot of it comes from... part of it is the Roman stuff that we do is kind of... As far as neighborhoods, maybe the Trastevere neighborhood, which is like the butcher's neighborhood, which a lot of the fifth quarter cooking comes from, the sweetbreads and the testa and things like that. Mm-hmm. That all comes from that neighborhood in Rome. So... Probably about half the menu is real Roman stuff or interpretations or Roman things. And some things are just real Lupa things that have been done there. The restaurant's going on 10 years, I think, in October.
Yeah.
So there's a lot of classic things that aren't necessarily Roman, but they're specific to Lupa and Lupa favorites. And then about another third of it is just kind of seasonal, market-driven Italian food that...
It has a real Southern Italian flair, though, because you have a lot of things with sort of agro dolce or with raisins and almonds or stuff like that. Things that I think of as really specifically Southern Italian as opposed to like Emilia Romagna or something like that, which is a little more, I think of as sort of cold weather cooking somehow. It doesn't have the Moorish influence, I guess, is what I'm thinking.
Yeah, spices and things like that. I think you got that right. Yeah.
Is the Trastevere neighborhood, is that more certain cuts that they use?
Oh, I'm sorry, Testaccio. Testaccio.
Oh, is that the
neighborhood? Yeah.
So is it certain recipes that make that neighborhood different cuisine, or is it actually the cuts that they'll use?
I think it's a little bit more about the cuts and the history that comes out of those cuts. A lot of the butchers and the factories there, they received kind of as payment or supplement their income some of the parts that weren't primal cuts and things that were used for them. So it was more about making things out of there. And I think even if you go there now, they still serve things that even here in New York, for people who really say that they like those kind of things. Some of the things that they serve now are even a little bit too much, even a little bit too much for me, like tendon salad with like salsa verde. I don't know.
Beef tendon?
Not everybody loves that, but
that's very somebody Chinese, who likes, right?
Well, it's just all about the Chinese do it, you know.
Well, it's cucina povera. So yeah, it's exactly. You know, it's for poor people. It's exactly. Like, well, how you make something taste good, even if it's kind of a questionable piece of the animal that you wouldn't necessarily
but
want
they use
cook.
everything.
And how did you grow up? Were you growing up in that cuisine anyway, or did you just come and learn it when you first came to Lupa?
Well, I think my grandparents are Italian, so I grew up in an immigrant town in Rhode Island. A lot of
I'm from Rhode Island.
Oh, really? It's Bristol.
Oh, I'm from Matunuck.
Oh, well, there you go.
That's South County,
more up by the beach, but my town is most people are either of Italian descent or Portuguese descent, right. And they really kind of celebrate their heritage, I think, and kind of keep a lot of that alive, either through like gardening or bacalá. I was first familiar with it as a Portuguese thing, not as an Italian thing. Hmm. And so growing up there, my mom had a garden, things like that, and my grandmother, my great grandmother cooked, and you know, I can still remember some of the things that she would make. She would even make brajol like we make now with your pork, mm-hmm. with heritage pork. She would make it with just the skin.
Wow.
And braise that with just the skin, which is...
Wow. I'm amazed she could even
some really
find
old
pork
things
skin.
Like that, yeah. Well, that was a long time ago. That's my great-grandmother. Mm. So she's gone now, but...
And so you grew up in an environment, and then did you go to culinary school?
I did. I grew up there, then I went to cooking school, and a lot of what I did in New York before was French-influenced stuff, and then probably about 3 years ago, I started working for Mario Batali and Mark Lettner, and mm-hmm. that's where I kind of reconnected with all that kind of things, and it really feels like home to me now, yeah.
What do you do with all that shoulder? I mean, I wish there were more restaurants like you. I mean, you must use it for many different dishes.
It goes a lot of places, I guess. I mean, we eat a lot of it as the staff. There's just so much of it that we do buy, and a lot of trimmings and stuff. But it's very popular, and people like it. And pork shoulder is a cut that just has a lot of applications, and you can use it in so many things. And
isn't
it's,
shoulder
and it's
what
good.
They also call like the? It's the picnic shoulder, and it's what they use for pulled pork.
They call
so
it picnic
it's a kind
or
of a
pork,
fibrous
pork butt.
Cut that shreds up nicely if you cook it long enough. Uh-huh. Or what else do you guys do with it? What do you? You make brajol with it.
We make brajol. We make ragu with it. It goes into, let's see, stuff. Certainly any kind of stuffed pasta.
So you grind it as well.
Grind it. Yeah.
Yeah, it's a nice fatty piece. Yeah. So it has a lot of
For those and
a
lot
out
of
there, it's something
a
look
a
for in the grocery store. Yeah, because it's mm-hmm. worth learning how to cook a pork shoulder. Because it really just requires a little time.
And a little goes a long way, you know. You buy an 8-pound piece, it could feed 15, 18 people.
Yeah. Or I think of it in terms of like how many meals am I going to get out of a specific piece of meat or whatever it is mm-hmm. I'm buying. I mean, I try to make that economy for myself. And I think that's something that people really would do well to think about for themselves in terms of budgeting their food mm-hmm. for the week. Is like, how many meals am I going to get out of this? I'm going to buy this. I'm going to cook it. It's going to lose 2-3 pounds in the cooking. Then I'm going to shred it up. I'm going to use it for this, and this meal. Yeah. And that's obviously what restaurants do. But I think that that's an application that families could use as well, right?
Certainly, yeah.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah. The lesser cuts, you know. Shoulder's still a lesser cut. Well, we are about to take a break, and then we'll come back for another segment with Cruz, and I want to ask him some questions about Spanish people making Italian food in Spain. So we'll be right back with Cruz.
Gonna be real, and there's nothing stronger than the love I feel. There's a thin gray line.
So here we are back at the main course with Katie Kiefer. I'm Patrick Martins. And we're with Cruz Goler, and I wanted to ask Cruz, I read this article in the Los Angeles Times about these Italians going completely ballistic because Ferran Adrià of Il Bulli fame, and, you know, the kind of scientist chef that, you know, deconstructs foods, is opening a pizza place. And the Italians are going crazy. And a couple weeks ago, we had one of your partners in the Vitaly Bastianich group, Mario Carbone, talking about how, you know, it doesn't matter what culture you're from, you can still make great bolognese sauce even if you're from Tunisia. And I was just going to ask your opinion about, like, chefs jumping cultures, and, you know, can that happen and can that still be good?
I think it definitely can. I mean, I can understand how they might be territorial about it, or possessive about the things that started there, and they might feel belong to them, but you know, we've had a lot of luck with cooking Italian food, I think. So I don't see anything wrong with it
in our country. So crossing over, I mean American food is all about bringing in different cultures, but it's funny how each country in Europe especially has their own specific, you know, dishes that are theirs, and obviously the feeling in Italy is pizza cannot be translated into Spanish cuisine.
Even though the tomato comes from the United States, or,
yeah,
you know, from
North America,
the Americas, yeah. Mm-hmm. And there's also this desire to just cook for more people, Ferran Adrià said. Like, he just didn't want to be cooking for a few thousand people a year at this expensive restaurant. And that seems to be a trend with chefs. I mean, one of the big things is they were saying in this article that, you know, the idea of a fancy chef like Mario Batali coming and then doing a pizza place is normal. But in Italy, it's quite the opposite. If you're a great chef, you're not supposed to do. And yet it seems like in the States, there's this young, brash, new generation of chefs that are like practically wanting to do food carts or taco stands.
Well, even Daniel Boulou, I was reading today, is opening a new, much lesser expensive, low price point restaurant. It's a nod to CBGB's. DBGB downtown. So he's jumping on really what was in a way kind of a Lupa bandwagon, because Lupa was one of the first really good restaurants to bring down the cost so that, you know, sort of normal citizens like us could actually afford to eat there.
Is that still a goal of Lupa? I mean, what's your highest point?
Well, sometimes we might use like a real special whole animal or something where we have to kind of charge a lot for it. But for the most part, it's very budget minded. And I think a lot of what we get is we charge for is on the plate. And but as far as cooking things like pizza and food carts, and I mean, I think it's, for me, I spent a long time doing French food, and doing this kind of food and this style of food is very like refreshing and comforting, and it's nice to make people happy and nice to make a lot of people happy. And I don't see anything wrong with it. I think it's,
yeah, it's pretty cool. Well, these poor Italians, yeah, I don't know why they call it theirs anyway. Like I say, the tomato comes from...
Well, not only that, but I think pizza was even kind of a construct of the Americans, didn't it come from North America first and then sort of work its way back into Italy? I don't think that pizza is an indigenous Italian food.
You've just gotten Heritage Radio Network banned in Italy, I think, for saying that. I don't think they'll ever forgive us. It's funny. This is so Italian. That same article, they sent Ferran Adrià, Slow Food did, to learn pizza from an expert. So they sent him to Aldo Brandi, who they say is the descendant of the inventor of the margarita pizza.
Okay, then
which
I stand
is so
corrected.
Absurd. I mean, it's also as if he would know a lot about pizza because his great grandfather was. And interesting about nature not being constant. Someone said there about pizza. Like, do you think like the water changes the taste of a mozzarella here versus there? I mean, can you know what I mean? People are like, oh, they can't make great pizza in America because they don't have the proper water or the right flour or something. I mean, is it that ingredient based, or is it just what's buying seasonal and local at the market?
No, I think, you know, base ingredients like that can actually change a great deal. You know, especially like something you might think as simple as flour, there's really like a lot to it, and there's a lot of deviation went in, and certainly some of the water that comes out of the pipes here is, you know, it's really not the same as something that's a little more pure. So I think you can work with it and make it happen, but you really have to recognize that a lot of those things can make a big impact on what, especially something that's just so simple, so few ingredients. Mm-hmm. Really have to take those things into consideration.
And we have another minute or so. I wanted to ask, like, since you've had so many great chefs come before you at Lupa, like, what is some of the things that you pride yourself on having brought to that restaurant? Is it more maintaining that very level, high level of consistency, or have you introduced a certain style or certain dishes that, you know, have added kind of to the pantheon of that institution?
Well, I guess the only thing that I can say is to try to... the challenge there is to try to improve upon it, and to kind of maybe leave a mark on the history of what it is without doing something that's really just out of the context of the restaurant. And hopefully I think I'm doing that really just through, the best thing I can do is just explore better products that are local. And with this whole, I think the whole local movement is just gains momentum all the time. And I think if I can kind of tap into that and keep Lupa on course with the rest of what's going on, bringing in, farmers that have newer stuff and things like that. That's really how I feel I can, and imparting that on the next, generation of cooks who work there who maybe don't really understand it.
That's what we think about that. That is very, very hardcore. Well, Lupa Restaurant, it's actually located on...
Thompson Street.
Thompson, like 152 Thompson?
It's actually 170 between Bleecker and Houston.
Bleecker and Houston. I know that street very well because I used to have to make the deliveries there out of the U-Haul back in the day. So there's no double parking on that street.
No, there's not.
That's for sure. Well, Steve, you're welcome to stay for the next segment, but thanks so much for being a guest. And, we're really big fans of what you do, so it's an honor that you came all the way out here.
Great. Thank you. It's great to be here.
All right.
We'll be right back with Nikki Rose.
Γαλάζο πράσινος γυαλό σαμάν γυαλό. Γαλάζο πράσινος γυαλό στα μάτια σου βρυχάτε. Γαλάζο πράσινος γυαλός στα μάτια σου βρυχάτε. Κι ο ποιος θα μπει, αχ, κι ο ποιος θα μπει και δε πνιγεί, αμάν και δε πνιγεί. Κι ο ποιος θα μπει και δε πνιγεί, θα έχει να το οδηγάτε. Γαλάζο πράσινος γυαλό στα μάτια σου βρήκα.
And we're back. It's The Main Course with Patrick Martins and Katie Kiefer is your host. This is the Heritage Radio Network. We're sponsored by Esposito's Quality Sausages.
Yes, we are.
And we're on now with Nikki Rose, who is the genius behind Crete's Culinary Sanctuaries. Thanks for joining us today, Nikki. It's a pleasure to have you on.
Hi, Katie.
Tikanis.
Kala, Asis.
Kala, Afkaristo.
Your Greek is very good.
Afkaristo.
Okay, well, I'm lost. Afkaristo. Nikki, tell us about Crete's Culinary Sanctuaries. What is this program? This is like agrotourism at its most refined?
Yes, it is. I've been doing this for 11 years, and we started out just... hosting chefs who wanted to learn about production, olive oil, wine, cheese, honey, bread. And so it just took off from there. The chefs and their spouses wanted to do more. And what does that mean?
That's our takeoff.
Right on, man.
And so I started looking around for other places. I heard about other eco-lodges on the other side of the island and tried to find ways to connect the communities with these eco-lodges so we could really form a rich cultural and culinary experience where we could grow wheat, watch the wheat growing and watch it being ground and all these things that I never got to learn in cooking school.
Hmm.
So your background is as a chef.
Right.
And that's how you got interested in this. And you're Greek American?
Yes.
So you went back to Greece as a child. Are you from, were your family was from Crete originally?
Yes.
Because that's your, obviously where you base this.
Mm-hmm.
And so what, I know that we were talking earlier before the show started about sort of the dichotomy between tourism and wanting those touristic dollars and at the same time wanting to preserve the cultural heritage of places like Crete or anywhere that, that still hangs on to some of the old ways of life. And so how have you been able to straddle that that divide there between, you know, bringing people in and the development that that implies and keeping things, you know, more or less the way they've always been?
We're offering an alternative to mass tourism. We can't fight mass tourism because it's a machine that's $1 million or more for a lot of people. But what we see is that a lot of people in Crete are being squeezed out by tourism and abandoning their communities because they don't have a choice. And so if we can help a few people in villages to support what they do, their traditional trades that they want to carry on, then perhaps we can save a couple villages instead of watching them all become abandoned. So,
and where are people? I mean, so what you're saying is that tourism, by building big hotels and bringing in large groups of sort of tourists who are not interested in the traditional ways, the people who have normally practiced like bread making or olive growing or olive pressing, stuff like that, they're being squeezed out by the growth of development of hotels and stuff. And so,
or is it the loss of attention within amongst the Greek people themselves?
I mean, it's both.
Yeah, that's what I was getting at. Thank you.
Because I guess when you look at modern living, people embrace that. They see the TV in the villages now, and they see movie stars and rock stars, and they want what those people seem to have. And so they don't want to work on the farm anymore. It's hard work, it doesn't pay off, and the demand for their quality products is dwindling, so even among the community. So there's a lot of people who are really dedicated to artisan production, and we've got to find a way, we keep finding ways to support their work and make it good for them.
What are some of the favorite artisans that you include on your tours and that maybe you've helped to, you know, reacquaint people with?
There's several, but some of my good pals that I work with very often, Yorgos, he's got a olive oil production on the west, and he's a genius, but he's very modest about it. He's incorporated the old system of the stone press and rigged it to electrical wiring, and then he's also got the traditional mats that he uses, and it's all an incredible production, and organic, sustainable organic, of course. And then there's winemakers, boutique winemakers I work with, some people who don't sell their cheese at all, they just make it for their families. So we have a interesting mix of about over 40 people in our network now.
Does it cost more, I mean, as the years go by, has it cost more and more for these people to pursue their craft? And is that one reason why their children or grandchildren are not staying in the business? Or is it really just sort of the commerciality of Western living in general that's forcing this exodus, say?
Yeah, both. Because when we look at just land and preserving the land amidst mass tourism, we've got shepherds who used to be able to take their flocks on public land, which is now being developed and land that's owned by people who left it for years, and the shepherds had a lot of territory to cover, and now they don't. So we see both issues there.
Well, very, very interesting. We want to come back for one more segment, so we'll take a 30-second break, and we'll come back with Nikki Rose on the Heritage Radio Network. Happened since Greece, although I've been worried about that country going downhill a little bit in the past 3,000 years. They haven't quite, they're not threatening for world domination anymore like they used
to. No, they're not. I don't know what's happened to the Greek character.
I think it's the weather is so nice and the fish is so good. You know, I lived two summers in Samos, which in a little town called Kakari, which means little lemon, I believe, or little orange.
There's a restaurant called Kakari in San Francisco.
I know. I love Kakari. They buy a whole pig from us every week.
I love them too.
So how can people come on to your tours? I mean, if someone wanted, how long do they run? And like,
yeah, tell us about what is the average, what happens when you go on a tour with Crete's Culinary Sanctuaries? What's the program here?
Well, we begin at the Minoan Palace of Knossos. We have to start at the beginning, 4,000 years of production, agricultural. So we look at the history of the Minoan civilization, so we get an idea of what's to come, so that people know that we've been producing olive oil in this region for over 4,000 years, and what does that mean now, and how have we carried on these traditions, how have they changed the production, etc. And so then we go to a museum called the Labyrinth, which you just heard some of the music from the man who opened this museum called Ross Daly. And it's a museum with traditional instruments. And so then we get to meet with those guys. And then we go to a winery, organic, and get to taste a little wine. And then the rest of the days are spent traveling around the hillsides and to Zeus's cave, botanical hikes. We meet with botanists, mountaineers, cooks, and basically run around the island trying to meet everyone we can in 6 days. Mm. So
people get to sample a lot of artisanal products. They get to meet chefs or cooks who work there. Is there a big tourist industry already in Crete, or is that something that you're trying to kind of stave off that development?
Well, I can't do anything about that. I can only offer an alternative and hope that there's enough people who are interested, which there have, for the past 11 years there have been.
And how do people find out about you, Nikki? Where's your website, and how can people learn more about Crete's Culinary Sanctuaries?
Well, our website is cookingincrete.com. And
that's easy to remember.
Yeah, there's a lot of photos on the website. There's lots of recipes and information, articles I've written. The most famous is What's the Mediterranean Diet and Who's on It Anyway? So you get an idea of what my attitude is towards that. And so we have information. We have different types of seminars. We have seminars just for professionals. and we keep 6 or 7 public programs every year, seasonal, and then we do olive oil production in January for real people who are really interested, because it's not beach season in January. So.
Oh, wow. Well, this has been, thank you so much for coming. We've told everyone you came in from Greece just for this show, so play that
up
if anyone asks. But we had Steve Jenkins, we had Cruz Goller, and now Nikki Rose. This was a really organized show.
Yeah, I know, huh? God, it's happening.
It's only 1 hour, though. That's too bad. But thanks, guys, for being on. And next week, we're off Memorial Day.
Next week for Memorial Day. And the week after, we'll be back with Gene Mayer from Baldor and maybe a couple of other distributor types, so we can talk about how food gets where it's going and why we get what we get in grocery stores.
You're a real cougar for getting us Baldor. No problem. Well, thanks. We'll be back next week.
Okay. We'll be back week after next.
I mean, week after next.
Stay tuned for the Q Report.
Great show.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.